This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We are going to learn how to grow food, even in a cold winter. Plus, the fine points of secretly planting food in public and private spaces. Gardening? Alex, don't you know Europe is nearing financial collapse? That North America and the whole global economy could experience a long-term crash? Can't you cover things that matter? Trust me, if any of that happens, growing or finding your own food will matter. A lot. We'll tell you how. We'll talk to the granddaddy of winter gardening, Elliot Coleman. If he can bring in fresh greens and even make money doing it in Maine winters without any heat in the greenhouses, you can do it anywhere in the United States, southern Canada, Britain, Scandinavia, and many parts of Russia, and you can do it cheap. We'll follow up with the details from an interview in an unheated greenhouse at the Center for Urban Organic Gardening in Guelph, Ontario, Canada. In between, we'll have a fun chat with Chris Tomlinson, the Gorilla Gardener of Love in the UK. We may have to sneak around a bit, putting food in waste spaces. If the UK economy crashes as hard as it looks, ordinary people will be grateful to find a little support from the landscape. Your town would be too. On the darker side, we'll hear a first-hand account of signs, the start of the global famine in an overheated world. One organic grower tells us why gardens in Austin, Texas failed in 2011, and it wasn't the drought. Don't miss it. Off we go to grow a quiet revolution. Nothing but paralysis or violence will come from the top. We need to start in the ground. We want fresh, organic, local food. Now, with a sour economy and rising food prices, that all just gets better. But most of us buy agribusiness produce in the winter when nature doesn't exactly encourage growing our own. Master gardener Elliot Coleman says we can grow food year-round, and you don't have to live in Florida or Southern California to do it. From his famous Four Seasons farm in Harborside, Maine, Elliot tells us how in his Winter Harvest Handbook. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Elliot Coleman, welcome to the program.
Hi, Alex. I'm glad to be here.
Well, growing fresh food in a New England winter, is that really possible?
Oh, it certainly is, and it's just a case of putting up enough protection to make the crops you're growing think that they aren't in New England but are somewhere milder. And you can get the first layer of protection very inexpensively with a simple plastic-covered hoop house. And by hoop house, I mean that it's constructed of bent pipes in the shape of a croquet wicket that are tall enough for you to walk under. There's one maybe every 4 feet, as long as you want to make it. And then you cover it with a sheet of clear plastic. It's best if it's greenhouse-grade plastic because the stuff you might buy at the hardware store is not protected against ultraviolet rays and will degrade quite quickly. So that first layer, that simple little translucent tunnel, will move the growing area about 1.5 USDA zones, and those are the zones in the map that tell you where you are vis-a-vis what will survive in the winter, depending on how low your temperatures get. 1.5 USDA zones, or here on the East Coast, about 500 miles to the south. So as I walk to the greenhouse on a normal winter morning, I'm in Maine. I walk into the greenhouse, I'm in a climate of New Jersey. So that's pretty neat. And I'm getting that without any heat input or any expense other than putting a plastic sheet over a simple frame. Then came the miraculous thing that we stumbled upon as we were first doing this. What if we put, let's say, a greenhouse inside the greenhouse? And the easiest way to do that was to put wire wickets over the beds in the greenhouse, one about every 4 feet, and then put a layer of one of those spun-bonded fabrics that you see on small tunnels in people's backyards that let air, light, and moisture pass. And all of a sudden, voila, you have the second layer. It moves the covered area another 500 miles to the south. And my greenhouse garden, instead of facing a Maine climate, is facing a Georgia winter climate. Now, that's pretty nice for spinach, for scallions, for Swiss chard, for any of the Asian greens, but it probably isn't going to allow you to grow tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants. And you can figure that out because they aren't growing tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants in Georgia in the winter. But you have a climate that will allow you to grow any of the hardy European or Asian crops that are traditionally grown in the winter in those parts of the world.
But you do heat some of your greenhouses. Why is that?
Well, we experimented around once we found that we could do with no heat at all with what could we do if we kept it just above freezing all winter. And we learned that because we did notice that crops are growing along very nicely until you get your first hard freeze under the inner layer in the greenhouse. And then they say, oh, whoops, I guess this is serious. And they slow down for about a week, and then they'll keep perking again. And we said, well, wow, what if we kept it just above freezing? Wouldn't that be neat? So we experimented with that for about 5 years, and it was amazing. We got double the yields and double the number of crops that would play this game. But the cost of propane really makes one wonder about whether it's worth doing it economically, and using non-renewables definitely made one wonder whether it was worth doing it from the point of view of the future of the planet. Now, we could have done it with a wood heat system, but what we learned from those 5 years of trials was that we were getting so much really good, exceptionally tasty food. And by exceptionally tasty, I mean that a lot of these cool weather crops love the cold of winter, if as long as they aren't outside being killed by the cold, dry winds. But we were getting so much good stuff from the unheated system, and that was so simple and uncomplicated that we decided that we would continue researching just along those lines.
Have you tried using water barrels to stabilize the day-to-night temperature swings?
Yes, there was a lot of work done in this country and a little bit done in Europe. Putting large translucent containers filled with water in the greenhouse that would be warmed up by the sun during the day and then give off heat at night. In most of those cases, though, it was done by people who were stuck in the old greenhouse image that the reason you put up a greenhouse is to grow tomatoes. That seems to be the knee-jerk reaction or the word that comes to everybody's mind when you mention greenhouse. And I suppose it's possible to do it with no supplemental heat if you have enough barrels collecting sun heat during the day. But the reason we never were interested in it at all is because you don't have enough sun in the winter, long enough days, to make good-tasting tomatoes. It doesn't make any difference whether you have them. If they don't taste good, they aren't worth eating. Whereas the cool weather crops, like spinach and chard and scallions and carrots and the Asian greens, are spectacularly flavorful in the winter without the stress of heat. And so the other disadvantage of putting a lot of water-filled containers in the greenhouse is that they're taking up the space that could be growing crops. And whereas the hardy winter crops need no more protection than those two layers under which they are being warmed at night by the heat coming out of the earth, which was stored there during the day from the sun shining in, that's turned out to be so simple and so tasty that why complicate it?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest Elliot Coleman. We're talking about winter gardening. Elliot, maybe we should let listeners know a little bit more about you. Tell us about Four Season Farm and your partner Barbara, if you like.
Well, Four Season Farm is a wonderful story. Back in 1968, I had very little money and a compelling desire to want a farm, and all I could afford was some land that was covered with spruce and fir trees. Well, I was an adventurer, and that sounded like an adventure. So over the course of time, I've cleared 14 acres of that, worked very hard by bringing in organic matter and all sorts of nice minerals like lime and phosphate rock, to create an exceptionally fertile soil out of the poor forest soil we started with. And so four-season farm has been some sort of adventurer's dream of how much fun farming could be if you started with nothing and figured out how to be able to grow anything you ever wanted to eat. And that's basically what we do. And further to the fact that we're on the coast of Maine, way up here in the north, Alex, is the fact that if we'd figured out this winter production on a farm in Virginia, let's say, everybody would have said, well, that's nice for Virginia on south, but you could never do it further north. So the fact that we're farther north than anybody and we're doing it really gets people to brighten up and say, oh, my gosh, I can do that in my backyard.
And you two had a TV show as well?
Barbara and I were asked by the Learning Channel back in 1992 to do a TV show. It was called Gardening Naturally. And it was interesting because since we're way up here where we are behind everybody else's climate in the spring, we couldn't do it the way gardening TV shows are often done, where they're showing you what you should be doing in the garden that week. And so we set it up as if it were a book. And there'd be a chapter on tomatoes, there'd be a chapter on growing broccoli, or a chapter on different herbs or shrubs or flowers in the garden. And we did 52 episodes in total, 26 each in 1993 and 1994. And I always thought it was the best gardening TV show ever done, but then again, I'm probably prejudiced.
Well, before we get back to winter gardening, could you tell us briefly about the other books that you've published?
The first book I wrote was called The New Organic Grower, and that first came out back in 1988. And I'd been in this game since 1965, and during those years, trying to learn how to farm organically and grow things successfully, I had gone and visited an awful lot of very smart, very nice people who were kind enough to share information with me. And I wrote that book as a way of paying them back by passing it on to future generations. So that's basically a textbook on organic gardening and farming. The second book was back when we were first experimenting around with winter production in our home garden. And it's written for home gardeners. It's called Four Season Harvest. And it just explains some of the simple techniques we used when we were first figuring out, oh, my gosh, you can eat fresh food in January, and isn't that neat? And then the third book, as we got into doing it on a commercial basis on the farm here, the Winter Harvest Handbook is aimed at commercial growers and large-scale home gardeners who want to get really serious about this and feed not only themselves but a few neighbors also.
You brought up one of the second challenges of winter gardening, which is not just the temperature, but the lack of sunlight in the winter. And I've got kind of a crazy question for you. Would it make any sense to add grow lights like the marijuana growers use?
Well, if I were growing produce that was worth as much as what they grow, I suppose I could afford to add in almost any input like that. But two things guide us. First off, there's the economics of what we might want to do. But the second is it going to get us produce that's as good as naturally grown produce? And if you picture the coast of Europe, you can go as far up as parts of Norway, which are way up there. And because of the Gulf Stream, they have a reasonably mild winter climate, and crops are even growing out of doors in the winter, although they have very short days. And yet that produce is perfectly healthy. It's feeding the deer and the antelope and anybody else who's wandering around. So if we were worried about length of day, we might want to put in artificial light, but we aren't, because all the crops we're growing seem to enjoy the amount of day there is. But the second factor is that I don't know if all of the rays or different photons or whatever you might want to call them that come from the sun are able to be reproduced by the lights that are presently available. And so I would be then stimulating my plants with an artificial light.
I notice you're not using a lot of plastic pots or even growing benches. Instead, you use the soil right on the greenhouse floor. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a good question, Alex. What the greenhouse floor does for us, the soil there, it does the same thing people were trying to get those water-filled barrels doing years ago. It stores the heat during the day. And then by having that low cover a foot above it held up on the wire wickets inside the greenhouse, that area is extra protected on a cold winter night. The temperature difference is such that when it's, let's say, 15 below zero Fahrenheit outdoors here in Maine, the low that night will be about 18 degrees above Fahrenheit under the inner layer. Now, as I said, that certainly rules out tomatoes and cucumbers, but all the hardy crops I've mentioned, they think that's just great. They don't mind freezing at night as long as the next morning the sun comes out, and as I say, when I lift up that inner layer in the morning and look under there, it looks like a perpetual spring.
And some people set their greenhouses in concrete, and you move your greenhouses around. Why is that?
Well, if you read up on the greenhouse literature, you can find that after a number of years, you can get into problems in a perpetually covered area like that. You can get a buildup of pests and diseases. You can get a buildup of excess nutrients because they aren't being flushed out by rain during the course of the year. By having a movable greenhouse, we gain two things. We get to take it off the land that it was on and put it over a new, clean piece of land and let the old land get winded on, rained on, sunned on, et cetera, and clean back up again. But also, we get to grow heat-loving crops in that greenhouse during the summer. For us here on the coast of Maine, it really speeds up the tomatoes and the eggplant and the peppers to have them in a greenhouse. And then we can leave those plants growing in that greenhouse as long as they will grow or before it freezes enough to freeze through there and kill them. And meanwhile, we have gotten the winter crops started, which need to be started before winter, on the plot next door. And then sometime in late October, early November, we just slide the greenhouse over to the winter crops. They're glad to have this a blanket of protection over them because they were beginning to get a little worried as the temperatures got colder. And we've gained both by cleaning up the soil and by having one greenhouse serve two purposes.
That just makes so much sense. Well, on another topic, when I was trying to feed our family from the land, I did read up about the way New England pioneers would force vegetables in their basements, even without light. I never tried it. Have you tried it?
Oh, yes. In fact, there are some wonderful games you can play that way that we learned years ago when before we had a greenhouse when we were trying to eat. And, for example, when we store cabbage in the fall in our root cellar, we pull it out of the ground, stems and all, break off the loose outer leaves, and put this sort of bare head with a stem and roots in the floor of the cellar. Then when we want to eat a cabbage, we bring that whole thing into the kitchen, cut the head off, and replant the roots and stem in a bucket of damp sand in a sunny window. All the stored nutrients in that stem, which would be used next spring to send up shoots and leaves in the process of making seed, suddenly burst out in greenery all along that stem, delicious edible greenery. So basically we've forced a part of the plant that most people would never think had anything edible in it at all, and it turns out to have a bunch of winter salads.
And Elliot, you don't just grow food, you sell it. How is the market for fresh produce in the winter?
Oh, the market is endless. In fact, I had a wonderful customer who, when we first started doing it after a couple of years, she told me that in the old days, she said she used to suffer through the winter looking forward to the great range of local fresh produce available in the summer. And she said now she puts up with the summer looking forward to the great range of fresh produce available all winter long. So it's really made a difference, and especially if you live way up in New England and winter's long and it's dark and it's cold and it's snowy. When you can go to the local market and there's a fresh baby leaf salad looking like it's May rather than January, it's a wonderful way to live.
Considering oil prices are always likely to go up in the long run, do you think we'll see a decline in food shipped from the South or even from overseas?
I suspect, but the oil prices will have to go up quite a lot. If you ever calculate the number, I think it's probably 30,000 heads of lettuce in a semi coming from California, and put that up against the amount of fuel that's being used, you would probably find that you could double or triple or quadruple the price of the fuel, and it would only add maybe 5 cents to the cost of each lettuce. But the reason that local produce is going to become more and more popular is because it's fresher. All the chefs in the restaurants we sell to, they love our baby leaf winter salad because they say when they get it from us, it's good and beautiful for up to 10 days. Whereas when they buy the California produce, it's a week old by the time it gets to them, and they're lucky if it has a three-day life. So it's freshness and flavor that are going to win out for the local fresh food business.
Elliot Coleman, if we've inspired some listeners to get started in winter gardening, how do they find your website and your winter harvest handbook?
Well, our website is fourseasonfarm.com. There's no S on the end of season, just fourseasonfarm.com. And you can see pretty pictures there of what we do, and different articles have been written about us or by us. And almost any bookstore, if you ask them to order it, can get you a copy of any one of my three books or the Winter Harvest Handbook if you want to be up to date with the latest information. And if you're like anything like all the people who have written us letters over the years, you're going to be just amazingly enthusiastic about what you can do in a season when you never thought you could do anything.
I notice you have an all-star cast recommending the book, everybody from Martha Stewart to Michael Pollan and Paul Hawken. Are you also plugged into the localization movement?
Oh, I think that is the most fascinating thing, Alex. The local food movement, if you look at it, I think over the last 5 or 6 years, has gone to where organic took 40 years to get to in a very short period of time. And, you know, that has to do with the fact that local means fresh, but also people like buying from a farmer who's right next door. I saw a bumper sticker once in favor of that, and the bumper sticker said, "Eat your view." And basically it was pointing out to people that if there aren't any farms around you, there's nothing pretty to look at. So the best way to keep farms around you is to buy food from your local farmers, and then they will keep farming, and you will have something pretty to look at.
Yes, and we've talked to other farmers about all the ecosystem services that farms provide, from capturing rainwater and stabilizing all sorts of things, so it's really very necessary. As we finish off, is there something else that you'd like to add?
just when you try this and get to taste how good some of these crops taste in the cool of winter, take some to your neighbors. Spread the word. This is really fun, and it's the type of thing that everybody in your community is going to want to do eventually, and then you can have gardening competitions in February as well as in July over who has the biggest and the best.
Maybe we'll have a February harvest festival. You have been listening to master organic grower Elliot Coleman. He produces food year-round in Harborside, Maine. Find his winter harvest handbook and other garden reading at fourseasonfarm.com. Elliot, you have inspired me to give this a try. Thank you for sharing with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Alec, and it's been my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. All those public lands clothed in lawns and decorative trees, they don't do anybody any good, and people are going hungry. Why haven't authorities clued in to the rising cost of food and poverty? I'm Alex Smith. We live in a lost landscape of the Victorian and middle-class city. Chris Tomlinson and the Gorillas of Love are determined to change all that. In the UK, Chris, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, EcoShock people. Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became a gorilla gardener.
It starts from, there was a book called The Green Pages, written by John Button back about 10 years ago now. And being a vegan from 1987, he kind of picked up on the issue of vegans are just as much consumerists as the rest of sort of normal folk who might have other diets, to which as usual, I read a lot, and it sort of prodded my conscience, and it sort of progressed from there. I started to grow my own food with an allotment, and then from that allotment, I got so addicted, I thought, sod just growing in allotment sites, take it further and grow in local neighbourhoods.
Are you still active in Nottingham, or have you moved on?
I moved from Nottingham, and when I was staying in Hastings, I planted quite a few trees and perennial vegetables and what have you, really, stuff like that.
And seeds don't cost a lot, but fruit and nut trees do. Where would you get the funding for that?
They got the funding for getting the fruit trees. I've not really yet done nut trees. It's interesting you raised that, because that would be inevitable progression. Got the funding from Ecotricity and the Lush Cosmetics people, who have sort of shops around the world, I believe.
And we're talking with Chris Tomlinson, who adds edible plants to the city. He's the founder of this group, Gorillas of Love. Chris, are there other gorillas out there surreptitiously changing the landscape?
The little group I've done, Gorillas of Love, was just to get the funding, which is me. It's out in the open now. But there are gorilla gardeners right across the world, so I believe, from arty people doing it just for art purposes, and to people like myself who are growing it for food and sustainable reasons.
What tips do you have for people who want to give it a try? How do we do it?
Well, first of all, it's interesting you say about cost-effective. I'm sure around the world there's different people, different sites for this. But it's a thing called FreeCycle, where you can sort of go online and offer your goods or things you can offer, skills or actual products. And I put an ad out for free for seeds, and I had a year's supply. So that was quite amazing. So it didn't cost me a penny for the seeds, and for the trees, as I say, I got funding. And coincidentally, I get the trees from Agroforestry Research Trust, Martin Crawford's charity that he set up, which is a really interesting little project.
Do you have to sneak about at night, or can you just casually walk up and plant a place, maybe dressed as a plausible city worker, or what? How do you do that?
It helps if you get yourself a fluorescent jacket. I've got one with Brighton & Hove written on the back, so it's exactly what the council workers would use if you want to do it in the daytime. But planting a tree can be quite a lot, can take a bit of a while, so yeah, I've planted them in the small hours. Yeah.
And what sort of places do you look for to do your planting?
Oh, unbelievably, I've planted, most of my successes have been in people's front gardens and public parks as well, and just to sort of blend in. Actually, in Hastings, they kindly actually put a tree guard around one of my trees and mulched it for me, because I obviously thought it was one of theirs. So camouflage your trees and have it done by your local council.
They adopted your tree. I love it. Well, what about the authorities? Have you had any problems with the police, or have you even had food plantings ripped out?
Yeah, I've had. Unfortunately, it's the trees that go first, because they just stand out. So I've had quite a few trees lost, about at least five now. And had I had trouble with the police, I've actually had a stop and search. And a run-in with one, PC Marriott, and he was fine, though. He said he's got an allotment in Battle. He was a nice side of the police. So it's not all bad. It's all sort of, it's wins and losses. And
yeah, it's terrible to be caught with those carrot seeds in your pockets.
Because the worst thing that can happen in England, it's civil offence. So it's just sort of minor trespass. I mean, the landowner can issue a notice to leave his land, or you could just be fined, which would be quite ironic when I consider it as quite a noble thing that I do, actually enhancing sort of rundown areas. I do operate in waste grounds, and I've been picked up on disturbing pieces of ground before because of wild sort of plants that might not be weeds to the unseen eye. And I'm trained in horticulture, so I understand not just to get into a piece of ground and rip anything out and replace it. Be quite sensitive on what you're doing, really, and read a good book on gardening, because it is gardening after all.
Yes, and you may not be able to get back and water it, so you're going to have to think about what could really survive where you plant it.
Exactly, watering, yeah. Always plant nearby. A, that's good to keep an eye on your little patch, and B, watering in the summer. I've learnt the hard way, Alex. I certainly have. You learn as you go along.
And I suppose humans are not the only ones to benefit. Some of our animal friends could use a little help as well. Is that what happens?
Yeah, when I was living in Hastings, in the back garden where I created a mini forest garden, I did notice an increase in sort of birds, and even had bats because one part of the garden, at the back of the garden, I just left wild. So I was quite amazed by that, yeah.
In the big picture, Chris, our city seems so purposely hostile, not just to nature, but even to the citizens. We pave over as much as we can to save maintenance costs, and then we plant the most boring ground cover and trees with no possible help for the population. How did we get into such a situation, do you think?
I think it's all from the mass consumerist drive that we're on, and hence the occupations happening across the globe. And I'd just like to say here, I think guerrilla gardeners have been doing occupations a lot longer than these Johnny-come-latelys. Tear up, put me out of the block. And we do permanent occupations once you put a tree in. If it gets left alone, that's my little occupation, I suppose. But getting back to your question was, I suppose people have become disconnected from the environment around them. And it's quite sad. It saddens me in my heart. But as soon as you touch that soil, like I have, because I had a breakdown a little while ago and through being quite down about life, gardening actually saved me. And I'd recommend it to anyone if they want to reconnect. Just get yourself a packet of seeds and take an allotment plot. It's not I'm against anything either. I'm in favour of anyone doing any form of growing. You know, all power to their elbows.
Well, you're not the first one who's been saved by gardening, I have to tell you that. You know, when I was in Morocco, the avenues were lined with orange trees. Everyone had free oranges. Is there any sign the UK is beginning to rethink this ban on creating an edible landscape?
Well, I think that's because of Transition Towns, Rob Hoskins. What he's done is fantastic. I just met him in the St. Paul's occupation the other day and shook his hand and said, respect, keep it going, Mr. Hoskins. I think there is a big awakening going on. And as someone said when I was staying in a Radical Roots co-op in England, gardening has become trendy. Unbelievable, but it is. To try and get an allotment plot, you have to be on a very long waiting list now. So there is a resurgence. There is, I think, there's a big change going on the planet at the moment.
What kind of feedback are you getting, if you'll pardon the pun? Have you heard from others around the UK or around the world?
Because I regularly check Richard Reynolds' website, www.guerrillagardening.org. That covers anyone can sort of send things in, and he'll have videos on there, and that's kind of our sort of international touch line to see what's going on out there.
Great. Well, we've been talking with Chris Tomlinson from the UK. He's been busy planting food in the cities of Britain as the founder of this group, Guerrillas of Love, which turns out to be mainly him, but there's lots of others following your lead, I'm sure. Thank you so much, Chris, and thank you for what you do.
Thanks very much, Alex. All power to anyone for any change in the world. We need it. Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You are tuned to the Radical Gardening Show on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex. I've got my getaway garden in a lovely hot spot. But will it be too hot to grow our food? In a few minutes, we'll tell you more about how to set up a winter garden, even in cold weather climates. But first, listen to this YouTube report from an organic grower in Austin, Texas, during last summer's record drought and heat wave. I expected a quick tour of barren, caked-out land, but the uploader, calling himself Humpty Dumpty Tribe, kept the camera on a green and flourishing garden. Why?
This is, you know, my organic garden. I got it in late this year. I didn't get it in until the middle of April. So I was about a month late getting the garden in. I admit that was a lot of this is my fault. So I planted it late and put in my tomatoes and peppers and everything, and so the garden grew absolutely beautifully. It grew beautifully. The plants are beautiful, all full of blooms. The little honeybees, they're, you know, going around doing all their pollinating and stuff. So I've got beautiful plants, full of blooms, full of honeybees. Everything is going along rosy. But I've noticed that the plants are not setting any fruit. I won't say none, but very few fruit. And I go, what is going on? And so I finally figured it out after Googling and studying that it's simply a matter of it's too damn hot. And it is, you know, it's June 8th, and already for days and days already, it has been triple digits in Austin, Texas. As I say, this is the hottest summer we have ever experienced. So in every day, it's been, you know, 100 damn degrees, and the low at night has been like 75 to 77 degrees. Well, if you Google poor fruit set on tomatoes, for instance, you will find out that the reason for poor fruit set are temperatures. And it says when the temperatures are steadily above 85 degrees during the day, and they're steadily above 85 degrees during the day, and more importantly, when the temperatures don't get below 68 degrees at night, that plants don't set fruit. They just don't set fruit. And so I will show you a classic example of this. So right here, these beautiful tomatoes. Now this is just on the same plant. Look at all these tomatoes now. They're not ripened yet. These are mostly beefsteaks. These tomatoes, we put these plants in, you know, right around the 1st of April. This is a dozen plants, but you notice they're all down here. They all set fruit very early in the season, and there has been no fruit set since. So you down here, you know, we've got dozens and dozens of beautiful looking tomatoes, and the higher ones, even though they're full of blooms, they're not setting fruit. See, these are the low guys, but much more striking than this. So here's what we've got in this garden right in front of your eyes to demonstrate this famine. So this row of tomatoes was put in around the 1st of April. Now, we were really lax on the second row of tomatoes, so we did not get these tomatoes in for about 3 weeks later. So we put our second row of tomatoes in. This is 9 tomato plants, these big, beautiful beefsteak tomato plants. 9 tomato plants. We have 1 tomato off of 9 plants. The plants are beautiful. They're full of blooms, as you can see, and they're setting no fruit out of 9 plants, which we should be getting about at least 100, if not 150 tomatoes. We have 1 tomato. This is because the temperature by the 1st of June is where the temperature in August in Austin, Texas, is usually by the middle of July or the 1st of August. It is so damn hot. Now, and look at these watermelons and cantaloupes. I mean, they're full of blooms. I mean, look at it, and you can see the honeybees going all around, and they're absolutely gorgeous plants. Setting all these blooms, we should be getting out of this gorgeous melon bed. This is cantaloupes and watermelons. We should get, I figured, about 100 cantaloupes and about 50 watermelons. So far, I have found 5 cantaloupes and 1 watermelon so far that are forming. Same story with these absolutely gorgeous pole beans. I should have picked well more than a bushel of beans. They're full of blooms. The plants are beautiful. They're blooming. There's no bean setting. There's just no fruit setting. So here you go, guys. Here is a tremendous effect on the food supply directly related to record-breaking hot temperatures in Austin, Texas. Now, you know, I'm just gardening. This is more of a hobby than anything, but if I was depending on my food for myself and my family and my friends, my tribe, and we were depending on this garden to feed us, we would starve. It is that simple. We're getting about max 20% of the food that we, I would say there is an 80 to 90% crop loss. 80 to 90% crop loss right here in South Austin, Texas, in one garden because of global warming and climate change. Is the fact that Austin, Texas is having its single hottest summer in history, hottest and driest spring and summer in history, is that related to the fact that in the year 2010, more greenhouse gases were dumped into the planet Earth's atmosphere than in any year in history? I don't know. Sounds like pretty good circumstantial evidence to me. And so, when these climate change fear-mongers start talking about global-wide famines in 20 to 50 years because, you know, we just won't be bringing the food in, and people laugh about that, guys, it's no laughing matter. Right here in Austin, Texas, here it is in living color, proof that famine is on its way. Famine is on its way, and I am on my way to Ecuador to get about 6,000-7,000 feet up the Andes Mountains, so I don't need to deal with this 100 degrees every day from here as far as it can see. Bye, guys.
That was a YouTube report from Austin, Texas, posted by Humpty Dumpty Tribe. Find the link in my blog at ecoshock.info. And now the inside dope on growing food in the depths of winter without extra heating.
This is Walter Garrison, the host of Locavore on CFRU 93.3 FM. And thank you very much for coming and tuning into our show today, Thursday, January 27th. Today we're going to be talking about season extension, and we're going to be talking to a very interesting man, Martin Rona, who's been doing work at the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming on season extension and growing crops in the winter time. It's a very interesting topic, season extension, something we really don't think about that much. Quite frankly, it's something that we don't do enough of. And in fact, there's a great opportunity to do a lot more with respect to growing crops in the late fall, in the early winter, and throughout the winter and into the spring. Now, one of the pioneers in season extension is a gentleman by the name of Elliot Coleman. And anybody that's been involved in the local agriculture movement or the organic movement would know Elliot Coleman's name quite well. He used to have a show on the Learning Channel called Gardening Naturally with he and his partner, Barbara Damrosch, who herself is a noted author in the field of horticulture. And they have a farm in Maine near the Penobscot Bay, which they have used to grow vegetables and produce year-round. It's really very interesting what they've done that far north as far as growing food for themselves. They've built, over the last several years, a thriving business as producers and purveyors of excellent winter vegetables, which they raise without major inputs of heat, extra light, or growth-promoting chemicals. And the key to their business can be summed up in three words: organic, local, and authentic. And what they have done really sort of sets what we as consumers of produce in the wintertime eat on its head, actually. Coleman talks about Americans having grown to depend on winter crops from California and Florida. He talks about the U.S. building highways and transport systems to get them to market in the north, and water being subsidized for irrigation. And it's, quite frankly, U.S. taxpayers that are subsidizing this. If you know, for example, the first name of the farmer that you deal with, then the food you buy can be labeled authentic. It may not be organic, but certainly it can be labeled as authentic. You know, it's very interesting when you look at it. When we look at latitude, and Martin's going to talk about this today, if you look at a place like Maine, Maine has the same latitude as Saint-Tropez. So Saint-Tropez, for example, and Maine get the same amount of winter daylight, and daylight is just as important as temperature. And Coleman's found that in southern France and northern Italy, locally raised crops are exactly what people expect to find in their market any time of year. And I guess when we look at local crops, we have to look at selecting winter hardy vegetables. And that is the first challenge. And the second challenge is, once you've selected those plants, is to protect them from severe freezes in the wintertime. And that involves using plastic greenhouses that arch above rows and maybe row covers as well, too. It's something that on the surface would appear to be a costly initiative, but actually growing crops in tunnels is actually economical. And if you look at a 3,000 square foot greenhouse now, in this is U.S. dollars and states cost, it cost them $6,000 to put up. So 3,000 square feet, $6,000 to put up, that's $2 a square foot. Try and find a house for $2 a square foot. We're looking at costs, housing costs being, I would say anywhere from $100, $125, $150 a square foot to start. So looking at a greenhouse to grow vegetables for yourself, that works out to about $2 a square foot, at least down in Maine. And hopefully they hope to gross about $100,000 a year growing greenhouse crops. You can do that. I think you'd be well on the way to sustaining yourself. So who would they sell to? Well, they'd sell to local markets and to local chefs. And looking at something like, for example, golden and deep red beets accompanying locally raised salmon at a restaurant, you know, salad greens, fennel leeks accompanying a leg of lamb, radishes, baby carrots, things that you don't expect to find produced and harvested fresh in the wintertime. It's quite possible. Coleman wrote a book called Four Season Harvest, which is probably the seminal book on season extension and what is possible, at least for us that live in northern climates. So I highly recommend that book. Check it out. Now, we're going to do an interview today with Martin Rona, who's been working, helping out at the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming. And what Martin's done is he's worked on growing winter vegetables in a greenhouse under row covers. So we're going to be talking with Martin today about what he's done with respect to producing vegetables in the wintertime. I wanted to ask about the future and what you see for initiatives that may be done with respect to the season extension work that's being done at the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming.
Well, I think part of the future could be, you know, involving students more and doing research here and reaching out to the community, showing people that they can make fairly simple structures as the hoop house that I built outside. They could easily build that in their backyard and grow lots of food locally, fresh, in their backyard. It's not that hard. It actually does work. It doesn't sound like it will work, but it actually does. And so we could have workshops involving people of the community to teach people that it's quite a feasible thing to grow fresh vegetables in your backyard in the winter.
So I'm standing in the middle of the greenhouse here at the GCUOF, and I see we have several beds in here with straw in between the beds. We have row covers over the beds and support systems for these row covers in order to have vegetables grow over the winter time. It's December 2nd today, and it's quite warm in here. Well, it's actually a lot cooler outside. So, Martin, could you go over how the greenhouse itself was prepared for in-ground growing and the greenhouse structure itself?
Okay, the structure is a large metal frame with two layers of plastic that are inflated. Well, actually, one half is. The other half isn't working so well now, but we'll work on that. And then inside, when I first came here, the ground was hard as a brick. It was like soil that had been compacted while it was wet during the construction of the frame. So it was pretty much useless for anything. And I spent about 3 to 4 months, about 3 hours a day, digging with a shovel to turn this into usable soil and adding large amounts of wood chip rich, mineral-rich compost from outdoors, and now we have very nice soil in here. Yeah, with our inflatable plastic structure and our inner layer of floating row covers, we are should be able to maintain these plants in here all winter long, even at minus 25 degrees. They may look a little iffy for a few days, but when the sun comes back, they'll all spring back to life again.
This is Radio EcoShock. You're listening to an interview with Martin Rona with Walter Garrison of The Locavore Show.
So next step when we look at a season extension is the greenhouse structure itself. And in this next segment, Martin's going to talk about the greenhouse structure and how it's set up and how it works. So let's take a walk around the greenhouse, and I just want to discuss some of the structural aspects of it with you. Mm-hmm. We have the support system here, and we have a side rail along the support system, and we have, is it fiberglass on either end or polycarbonate?
That's polycarbonate.
Polycarbonate, okay. And how is it inflated? Could you describe the system for that?
Well, we have a very long extension cord that goes to the parking lot temporarily, and we're plugged into a light post. That comes through the extension cord into the greenhouse. We have two small blowers that run continuously. That inflates our greenhouse. We should be getting a solar panel system this week, 1 kilowatt of solar energy, and that should power all our systems here. But because of the weather, this year's been kind of wet this fall, so the installation company has been a little delayed, and we're hoping that they'll begin soon. And we're going to have a small house built with batteries, inverters, and everything, and we can still run everything off the same at 120 volt, so that if the solar system, for whatever reason, goes down, we can still always use the extension cord to the parking lot method. But we hope to be off the grid. And we also have a well. Finally, we haven't had water for the first 2 years. Now we have a well that has been dug for us by the good people at the groundwater research facility. We're able to use their well. We haven't got a pump yet, but that's coming soon. And that will also be plugged into the solar batteries through the inverter in that little. And we also have a roof vent that opens and closes when it gets too hot in here. And that should be automated. And that will also run off the solar system. But at the present time, we still have some glitches with that system, which may take a few months to settle. But we're in no hurry. It's the winter. We don't need the roof to be open.
With respect to the well and water and irrigation, are you irrigating at all in the wintertime or not?
No. Most of these plants, once the soil is moist, it stays moist. And it probably will stay moist probably till things start growing again. Plants in here don't really grow from about 6 weeks before and after the winter solstice. So everything just goes, it grows imperceptibly or it becomes dormant. So it needs very little water. Once we get into the second week of February and the day length gets long enough, usually the day length has to be more than 10 hours for plants to grow. So it's the latitude that's important, not the temperature. And that's quite counterintuitive to most people. I think it's too cold to grow things here. But it's not. We have the same latitude as southern France. And they grow vegetables outside in southern France without any greenhouses. Mind you, they have a warmer climate, but we have the same day length. And often during winters, we have more sunlight than they do. So it's perfectly feasible to grow things here.
I wanted to ask you about when you think the ideal planting time is. When would you start planting for season extension to grow underneath the greenhouse and underneath row covers? What's the interval between plantings you'd use, and when would you stop planting?
Okay, I would start, if this was my greenhouse and it was up to me, I would start planting in probably the beginning of August with carrots and beets and things like that, root crops. The end of August, I would start planting my greens, and I would probably stop planting by the end of September. And I'd maybe leave a week between plantings or 2 weeks just to get some succession crops going. Unfortunately, this year I was a bit late, but I was constrained by having the summer crops in here. Or next year we can have a compromise between summer and winter crops.
That's interesting because it certainly puts the idea of planting and harvesting on its head. It spins at 180 degrees because you're actually very actively planting in August and September in preparation to have food available for you for the next several months.
Oh, yes. We want to stock our outdoor refrigerator.
Basically, just before winter solstice, if, I guess 6 weeks before, that is when you're going to end planting. And he talked about successional planting. So essentially, you could start in late August and start seeding, for example, carrots and seed them every 2 weeks. And then if you think winter solstice is going to be December 21st, you might want to plant every 2 weeks up till, let's say, about November 8th, something like that. So it's quite possible to have a successional harvest of greens, of root crops, following this method. Okay, now we're going to actually get into what crops Martin is working with at the GCUOF. I'd like to ask about the crops that you're growing here, when you planted them, and why you chose these specific crops to grow here.
Okay, well, most of the crops I've grown here we know are winter hardy. Kale, mizuna, well, there's two types of kale. Bordeaux spinach, arugula, red oak lettuce, cold hardy spinach, nice mesclun mixture, mustard greens, all kinds of things that have traditionally been used in for winter gardens. at least for fall and spring gardens, but they all manage through the winter as well. Another reason I chose some of these crops, because they're the only seeds I could scrounge.
Okay, so necessity.
Yeah, necessity. Yeah. And then at one point, I did go to William Dam Seeds, and I bought some Asian green seeds. Unfortunately, I planted some of my crops a bit too late because the summer crops were still in here. We wanted to keep them till Thanksgiving so that we could have our last big sale, then remove the summer crops. So there's some beds that I managed to plant at the end of August, and they're doing very well. They're quite mature. There's other crops that I didn't plant till the mid-October, but surprisingly, they're actually almost mature, which I didn't expect. And then there's some that I planted that are still very small. That was October 25th was my last planting of Asian greens. So they've sort of gone into a state of dormancy, and by mid-February they should start to grow. And by end of February, early March, we should have a nice crop. So I have plants in all different stages of succession in here as well. Apparently plants that are quite mature, fairly large, don't do as well with cold temperature. They succumb to stress more easily. Plants that are teenagers are a lot tougher. They can withstand more winter stresses and bounce back more easily. We have everything from very small to sort of mid-sized to almost mature plants. So we should have some good food to last us all winter and right till our outdoor spring crops.
Now, I see leaf litter surrounding some of the plants here, like the kale. Could you tell us why you actually have that here?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a good idea, but it's a bit of an experiment. It may provide some insulation around the kale. Outdoors, it's usually a good idea. You can keep your kale outdoors with lots of straw or leaves, till Christmas. Indoors, it may actually prevent the sun from heating up the soil around the plants, so it may not be a good idea. But I'm doing it as an experiment and to not necessarily being my idea, but other people have input as well. And if it works, it's something we can continue. And if it doesn't work very well, then we'll scrap that idea next year.
Have you tried any of the crops that have been growing underneath the greenhouse in the tunnels here at all?
Oh, yes. Last night I had a delicious dinner of mesclun with some arugula and some lettuce. Within half an hour of cutting it, I brought it home and had a lovely, delicious salad. It's very satisfying to have something that's fresh, that's local, that you've grown yourself. And because of all those reasons, it's very precious. You don't want to waste it, and you really enjoy it to the full.
What are other challenges that you've found that you've had to deal with in season extension?
One small challenge, I guess, is the meadow voles, a chipmunk, and a great many mice. But fortunately, there's a weasel that lives here. I've seen him entering the greenhouse as I'm leaving in the evening. He's actually done a very good job on the meadow voles. In the corner, actually, I dug my own little pit. I put in a 5-gallon plastic pail, put in some wheat or some grains, and meadow voles love that little trap. They all hop in there, and then when they're stuck in there and can't get out, along comes the weasel and has a little treat. The first little while, I was just using a watering can. I have quite a few rain barrels that I brought in here, black rain barrels that I filled up with water, which help absorb sunlight and keep the temperature fairly mild in here. At this point, I'm not watering at all. I probably won't have to water until, if we get a week of sunny weather, I might, and it gets quite warm in here. If, for example, if it was a nice, bright, sunny day all day today, and it was zero outside, it might be 15 or 18 in here. With the row covers on, that prevents some of the evaporation. But if plants aren't growing, there's not a lot of evapotranspiration happening. So, yeah, we could probably get away with that watering for quite a long time. So the water barrels there now are doing a different job. They're just trying to act as a heat sink. And then later on, when things start to perk up in mid-February, then I'll have to start using them as a water source for the plants again.
Has anybody done any research for either the ambient air temperature underneath the row covers or the soil temperature underneath the row covers?
Again, I would love to do that if I had the equipment. But at this point, I'm just looking after things, trying to make sure everything grows. And I just like to act as a support person for people who want to do projects. If there's students that would need extra help, I'd be glad to help them out. Or if people want to do doctorate studies, I'd be glad to act as a support for them. Yeah, there's lots of interesting research that could be done with this facility.
My thanks to Walter Garrison and the Locavore Show from the nonprofit campus and community radio station CFRU-FM at the University of Guelph, Canada. Find links to the full program in the Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. We are totally out of time. I'm Alex Smith. Our website is ecoshock.org. You heard a bit of background from Vast Mandana. Thank you for listening. Start your food insurrection, your own food bank, if you will. Plan your planting.